This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to lumbar spinal stenosis and bone growth factors, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with lumbar spinal stenosis, and the first question reads, which of the following is associated with increased risk of surgical site infection following lumbar spinal decompression? And the choices are 1, use of intra-wound vancomycin powder, 2, hair removal by clipping at the time of surgery, 3, use of morphine nerve paste applied to the dura after spinal decompression, 4, skin preparation with an alcohol-based prep solution rather than povidone iodine, and 5, failure to use chlorhexidine gluconate wash the night prior to surgery. So the use of morphine nerve paste applied to the dura after decompressive spine surgery has been used in an effort to mitigate postoperative pain, but has been associated with epidemic levels of surgical site infection. So the correct answer to this question is 3, use of morphine nerve paste applied to the dura after spinal decompression has an increased risk of surgical site infection following lumbar spinal decompression. Surgical site infection risk is modulated by a myriad of factors, both host factors and perioperative factors. Perioperative strategies to reduce infection that have been shown to be effective include 1, hair removal by clipping, not shaving, at the time of surgery, 2, use of an alcohol-based skin preparation agent, 3, use of perioperative prophylactic antibiotics, and 4, limiting operating room traffic from OR personnel. Kramer et al. Did a retrospective analysis of 148 patients who underwent laminectomy in order to identify risk factors for infection in the context of a sudden increase in infections. Regression analysis showed that the use of morphine paste resulted in an 18-fold increase in the risk of surgical site infection. 17 of 148 had developed infection during the epidemic period, compared to 15 out of 995. Cultures were positive in 10 of 16 cases. 7 of these involved skin flora. Histological exam showed foreign body reaction. Devin et al. Did a multi-center analysis of patients undergoing spine surgery at 7 spine centers to determine whether there was a difference in infection risk based on whether or not intra-wound vancomycin was used. They analyzed 2,056 patients, of whom 47% had vancomycin used in their wounds. The risk of surgical site infection was higher in those patients that did not have vancomycin, with a relative risk of 2.5. Moving on to the next question. Among patients with lumbar degenerative disc disease and low back pain, what factor is most predictive of clinical outcomes after surgical management? And the choices are 1, duration of symptoms, 2, workers' compensation, 3, use of disc arthroplasty, 4, severity of disc degeneration, and 5, number of spinal segments treated. So the treatment of low back pain ranges from non-surgical management to surgical management. Whereas many other treatment modalities have been investigated, lumbar arthrodesis remains the primary surgical treatment of lumbar discogenic pain. Outcomes of surgical management vary, but are consistently impacted negatively by workers' compensation status. Neither the radiographic severity of disease, number of spinal segments, nor duration of disease has been correlated with clinical outcomes. While total disc arthroplasty was hoped to be an improvement over fusion, the evidence available to date has shown no significant differences over arthrodesis. So the correct answer to this question is 2, workman's compensation. Moving on to the next question. A 63-year-old male with history of myocardial infarction presents with buttock and leg pain. He states that the pain is worse when climbing stairs and is absent when walking down a hill. He reports when walking on a flat surface, the pain begins after roughly 50 meters, but if he stops walking and remains standing upright, the pain resolves after a few minutes. He denies any leg pain when sitting and driving a car. These symptoms are most consistent with, and the choices are 1, neurogenic claudication, 2, vascular claudication, 3, lumbar radiculopathy, 4, cervical myelopathy, and 5, central cord syndrome. So this clinical presentation is most consistent with vascular claudication, making 2 the correct answer to this question. Vascular claudication refers to the pain, aching, or fatigue of the muscles of the buttocks, thigh, and/or calf that occurs with exertion and is related to a failure to meet muscular oxygen requirements, usually caused by peripheral vascular disease, impeding blood flow to the peripheral muscles. Neurogenic claudication is the classic symptom caused by lumbar spinal stenosis. Neurogenic claudication classically presents with bilateral buttock pain with upright activities, but seems to improve by postural changes that flex the lumbar spine. These posture changes are thought to increase the cross-sectional area of the central canal, which relieves pressure on the affected area. Isaac et al. Reviewed degenerative lumbar spinal stenosis. They state that patients with vascular claudication will have similar symptoms of leg cramping, whether ambulating or riding a stationary bicycle. In comparison, patients with neurogenic claudication have diminished symptoms of claudication while positioned seated. Young et al. Reviewed the use of lumbar epidural/transforaminal steroids for managing spinal disease. They report that 2/3 of acute low back pain episodes resolve within 7 weeks, so the utility and practice patterns regarding the timing and number of epidural/transforaminal steroid injections is usually based on expert opinion rather than high-level research evidence. Moving on to the next question. A 32-year-old man underwent a lumbar microdiscectomy and an incidental dural tear occurred. A hemilaminectomy was performed to obtain adequate visualization of the defect and primary repair of the tear was performed. 1 month postoperatively, he returns to the office complaining of severe headaches and occasional nausea, which is worse with standing. He denies fever or chills. On physical exam, his wound is well healed with no cellulitis or erythema. WBC and ESR are within normal limits. What is the most likely diagnosis? And the choices are 1. Viral meningitis, 2. Bacterial meningitis, 3. Vertigo, 4. Cerebrospinal fluid leak, and 5. Epidural abscess. So the clinical scenario is consistent with a persistent cerebrospinal fluid leak due to an intraoperative dural tear, making 4. Cerebrospinal fluid leak the correct answer to this question. The incidence of dural tears during spine surgery vary between 2 to 17%. In patients in the postoperative period, if there is suspicion of a dural leak, an MRI should be performed to look for a CSF leak. Once the diagnosis is confirmed, the gold standard treatment is reoperation. Less invasive methods of treatment include percutaneous fibrin glue, subarachnoid drainage, or an epidural blood patch. If these fail to relieve symptoms, reoperation is mandatory. Basacco et al. Showed headaches and nausea when standing up after spinal surgery are classic symptoms for dural tears and cerebrospinal fluid leaks. Other symptoms include photophobia, posterior neck pain, nausea, and vertigo, classically worse when standing or sitting. Wang et al. Found an increased incidence of dural tears with revision surgery. They found that a dural tear, if repaired properly, does not appear to have any long-term deleterious effects or to increase the risk of postoperative infection, neural damage, or arachnoiditis. Moving on to the next question. During lumbar decompression at L4-5, which of the following decompression techniques will destabilize the spine and require an L4-5 fusion? And the choices are 1. Removal of greater than 50% of the L4-5 nucleus pulposus, 2. Removal of the L4 and L5 spinous process and interspinous ligament, 3. A medial facetectomy, removing 20% of the right L4-5 facet joint, 4. Bilateral resection of the L4 inferior articular process, and 5. A unilateral hemilaminectomy. So bilateral resection of the L4 inferior articular process will destabilize the spine. Abumi et al., in an in vitro experiment using fresh human lumbar functional spinal units, found that total facetectomy, even created unilaterally, makes the lumbar spine unstable. They also found that medial facetectomy and division of the posterior ligaments consisting of the supraspinous/interspinous ligaments did not destabilize the spine. Lee et al., in another anatomic study that found unilateral facetectomy and resection on the contralateral facet markedly alters the rotational motion and destabilizes the spine. But the correct answer to this question is 4. Bilateral resection of the L4 inferior articular process will destabilize the spine and require an L4-5 fusion. Moving on to the next question. Patients with symptomatic spinal stenosis treated with surgical decompression compared to those treated non-operatively have what clinical outcomes? And the choices are 1. Worse clinical outcomes at 4 years. 2. No difference in clinical outcomes at 4 years. 3. Improved clinical outcomes in pain only at 4 years, 4. Improved clinical outcome in function only at 4 years, and 5. Improved clinical outcomes in pain and function at 4 years. So recent studies show patients with symptomatic spinal stenosis treated with surgical decompression have improved clinical outcomes in pain and function at 4 years compared to those treated without surgery. So the correct answer to this question is 5, improved clinical outcomes in pain and function at 4 years. The Spine Patient Outcomes Research Trial, or the SPORT trial, is a multi-center randomized controlled trial comparing surgical and non-surgical treatment for patients with lumbar disc herniations, lumbar spinal stenosis, and degenerative spondylolisthesis. Results of the randomized cohort were disrupted by a high crossover rate between the surgical and non-surgical groups. Therefore, they conducted, quote, as treated, statistical analysis as a prospective cohort study that was non-randomized. Based on the as-treated analysis, 2-year and 4-year results for spinal stenosis show improved clinical outcomes in pain and function. Atlas et al. In the main lumbar spine study also showed surgical treatment was associated with greater improvement in patient-reported outcomes than non-surgical treatment at 4-year evaluation. Katz et al. Showed that in patients treated with surgery for lumbar stenosis, those with greater medical comorbidity, functional disability, and increased back pain relative to leg pain were significantly less satisfied with the results of surgery. Moving on to the next question. A dural tear occurs during a routine lumbar laminectomy for spinal stenosis. A watertight repair is subsequently performed. How will this affect postoperative care and ultimate clinical outcomes? And the choices are 1, there is an increased risk of wound infection. 2, the patient must remain flat in bed for 7 days. 3, the clinical outcome will not be affected. 4, the patient will have a worse clinical outcome. And 5, the patient should remain on PO antibiotics for 10 days following surgery. So dural tears are more common during revisions, but they can almost always be repaired primarily with a good or excellent outcome and without additional complications. Closed suction wound drainage does not seem to aggravate the leak and can be used safely in the presence of a dural repair. Wang et al. Agrees with prior studies and found that an unintended incidental durotomy resulted in no substantial difference in the final outcomes of operative procedures on the lumbar spine. Therefore, Wang et al. Concluded that a dural tear does not adversely influence the long-term results of operations on the lumbar spine. So the correct answer to this question is 3, the clinical outcome will not be affected. Moving on to the next question, of the following, what is the most reliable method of assessing spinal fusion? And the choices are 1, radiographs, 2, MRI, 3, flexion extension radiographs, 4, CT, and 5, CT myelography. So despite the ease of attainment, radiographs only accurately diagnosed failed arthrodesis in 60 to 80% of uninstrumented cases, and these numbers are even lower in cases with posterior instrumentation. The role of dynamic radiographs remains unclear because of the paucity of normative data values after lumbar spine fusion. CT scans provide excellent bony detail, and their images are not affected by metal components as in MRI. Post-myelogram CT is useful for identifying neurologic compression. So the correct answer to this question is 4, CT. Moving on to the next question. A positive straight leg raise sign is when pain radiates distal to the knee when the affected leg is passively elevated. The increased tension generally occurs between, and the choices are 1, 0 to 30 degrees, 2, 30 to 70 degrees, 3, 45 to 90 degrees, 4, 60 to 90 degrees, and 5, 90 degrees. So a positive straight leg raise causes pain radiating distal to the knee when the nerve is under tension. This increased tension generally occurs between 30 degrees and 70 degrees of passive elevation, making 2 the correct answer to this question. Moving on to the next question, on an axial CT image, which of the following dimensions is considered to be indicative of a critical amount of lumbar spinal stenosis? And the choices are 1, AP canal diameter of less than 20 millimeters, 2, AP canal diameter of less than 50 millimeters, 3, cross-sectional area of less than 100 millimeters squared, 4, cross-sectional area of less than 50 millimeters squared, and 5, circumferential area of less than 25 millimeters. So lumbar central stenosis is defined by an AP canal diameter of less than 10 millimeters or a cross-sectional area of less than 100 millimeters squared as measured on CT, making 3 cross-sectional area of less than 100 millimeters squared the correct answer to this question. And moving on to the final question for this topic, posterior lumbar spine arthrodesis may be associated with adjacent segment degeneration, cephalad or caudad to the fusion segment. Which of the following is the predicted rate of symptomatic degeneration at an adjacent segment warranting either decompression and or arthrodesis at 5 to 10 years after lumbar fusion. And the choices are 1, 5.5% at 5 years and 75.5% at 10 years, 2, 10.1% at 5 years and 65.2% at 10 years, 3, 16.5% at 5 years and 36.1% at 10 years, 4, 26.5% at 5 years and 56.1% at 10 years, and 5, 49.2% at 5 years and 15.1% at 10 years. Ghiselli and Associates described a rate of symptomatic degeneration at an adjacent segment warranting either decompression or arthrodesis to be 16.5% at 5 years and 36.1% at 10 years based on a Kaplan-Meier analysis. So the correct answer to this question is 3, 16.5% at 5 years and 36.1% at 10 years. Moving on to the final topic for this review session of bone growth factors, the first question reads, BMP is FDA approved for well-defined medical conditions in limited patient populations. In which of the following clinical scenarios is use of RhBMP2 FDA approved? And the choices are 1, in a 32-year-old male with an acute open tibial shaft fracture treated with minimally invasive locked plating 8 days from the initial injury, 2, in the lumbar spine in a 45-year-old female undergoing posterior decompression and instrumented posterolateral fusion from L4 to S1, 3, in the cervical spine in a 56-year-old female undergoing anterior cervical discectomy and fusion of C5-C6, 4, in the lumbar spine in a 52-year-old male undergoing L5-S1 anterior lumbar interbody fusion for degenerative disc disease and spinal stenosis, and 5, in the cervical spine in a 60-year-old male undergoing posterior decompression and posterior instrumented fusion of C3 to C7. So RhBMP2 is FDA approved for use together with the lumbar tapered fusion device, that is the LT cage, in a single level ALIF from L2 to S1 levels in degenerative disc disease. RhBMP2 is also FDA approved for use in open tibial shaft fractures stabilized with an IM nail and treated within 14 days of initial injury. RhBMP7 has received FDA humanitarian device exemption approval as an alternative to autograft in recalcitrant long bone non-unions where use of autograft is unfeasible and alternative treatments have failed. It is also approved as an alternative to autograft in compromised patients, that is with osteoporosis, smoking, or diabetes, requiring revision posterolateral / intertransverse lumbar fusion for whom autologous bone and bone marrow harvest are not feasible or are not expected to promote fusion. Epstein reviewed the indications for RhBMP2 use and its off-label use. She found that anterior cervical surgery with BMP2 led to dysphagia and airway complications. With posterior lumbar surgery, complications included vertebral osteolysis, that is bone resorption, and ectopic bone formation / heterotopic ossifications, which made revision surgery difficult. Berkus et al. Prospectively compared 46 patients undergoing single-level ALIF with BMP2 versus with autograft in an industry-sponsored study. They found that patients receiving BMP2 had higher rates of fusion and improvement in pain and neurologic status at 12 and 24 months compared with autograft, and there were no adverse events. They recommended RhBMP2 in ALIF procedures to eliminate pain and scarring from iliac crest bone harvest. Moving on to the next question, which of the following is involved in the process of osteoinduction and osteogenesis? And the choices are 1, bone morphogenic protein 1, 2, BMP2, 3, BMP3, 4, peroxisome proliferator activator receptor gamma or PPAR gamma, and 5, insulin-like growth factor 1 or IGF-1. So bone morphogenic protein 2 or BMP2 is directly responsible for osteoinduction and osteogenesis, making 2 the correct answer to this question. To quickly review, bone morphogenic proteins were discovered as the bone-forming factors in demineralized bone used in surgical procedures. BMPs have therefore found a role in bone regeneration strategies as they have been found to initiate the complete cascade of bone formation. As members of the transforming growth factor beta or TGF-beta superfamily, BMPs play important roles in skeletal development and bone formation. BMPs initiate their signaling transduction by binding to a heterodimeric complex of two transmembrane serine threonine kinase receptors and BMP receptor type 1. The activated receptor kinases in turn phosphorylate the transcription factors SMAD1, 5, and 8. The phosphorylated SMADs then form a heterodimeric complex with SMAD4 in the nucleus and activate the expression of target genes in concert with other coactivators. BMP2 specifically exhibits potent osteogenic and osteoinductive activity. Cheng et al. Performed a study to determine the activity of 14 known types of BMP in mesenchymal progenitor and osteoblastic cells. Osteogenic activity was determined by measuring the induction of alkaline phosphatase. They found that BMP2, 6, and 9 significantly induced alkaline phosphatase activity in pluripotent cells, while BMP2, 4, 6, 7, and 9 significantly induced alkaline phosphatase activity in pre-osteoblastic cells. BMP3 was found to have no activity. They conclude that BMP2, 6, and 9 may play an important role in inducing osteoblast differentiation of mesenchymal stem cells. Kempin et al. Performed a study to determine if the sequential release of vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, and BMPs could enhance BMP2-induced bone formation. A microsphere composite of BMP2 embedded in a propylene scaffold surrounded by a hydrogel loaded with VEGF was implanted in rats. Empty microspheres or microspheres with either VEGF or BMP were used as controls. They found that in combination with local sustained BMP2 release, VEGF significantly enhanced ectopic bone formation compared to BMP alone. They conclude that sequential angiogenic and osteogenic growth factor release may be beneficial in bone regeneration. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following factors uses serine threonine kinase receptors to induce metaplasia of pluripotent mesenchymal stem cells into bone-forming cells? And the choices are 1. Bone morphogenic protein, 2. Osteoprotegrin, 3. Insulin-like growth factor 2, 4. Platelet-derived growth factor, and 5. RANK ligand. So bone morphogenic proteins use serine threonine kinase receptors to stimulate proliferation and differentiation of pluripotent mesenchymal stem cells into bone-forming cells. Bone morphogenic proteins are a highly studied family of growth factors of bone. With over 20 varieties of BMP, specific actions vary widely, with most effects revolving around the development and repair of the musculoskeletal system. In the inflammatory phase of healing, BMPs target undifferentiated mesenchymal stem cells through extracellular serine threonine receptors. Following this extracellular interaction, the signal is transmitted to intracellular molecules called SMADs, leading to different cellular responses. BMPs are of great interest given their ability to induce robust bone formation. Cited concerns regarding BMPs are uncontrolled heterotopic bone formation and cost. Cheng et al. Looked at the osteogenic activity of 14 different BMPs on mesenchymal progenitor cells. They found BMP2, 6, and 9 induced high levels of alkaline phosphatase activity in pluripotent stem cells. They conclude BMP2, 6, and 9 may play important roles in inducing osteoblast differentiation of mesenchymal stem cells. Lin et al. Reviewed the uses of platelet-derived growth factor, bone morphogenic proteins, and platelet-rich plasma in foot and ankle surgery. They state that BMPs play a large role in the differentiation and proliferation of pluripotent mesenchymal stem cells to bone-forming cells and cartilage. Moving on to the next question, which of the following contributes to the differentiation of mesenchymal progenitor cells towards adipose tissue? And the choices are 1. Bone morphogenic protein, 2. Peroxisome proliferator activator receptor gamma or PPAR gamma, 3. RUNT-related transcription factor 2 or RUNX2, 4. Sex-determining region Y, box 9, or SOX9, and 5. Wnt beta-catenin. So PPAR-gamma is a regulator of mesenchymal progenitor cells that induce adipocyte formation, making 2. PPAR-gamma the correct answer to this question. Mesenchymal progenitor cells, often referred to as mesenchymal stem cells, are upstream cells that can form myoblasts, chondrocytes, adipocytes, and osteoblasts, among other types of tissues. Numerous regulatory pathways have been explored to understand and manipulate these differentiation pathways. PPAR-gamma has been known for many years to influence adipogenic differentiation, most likely at the pre-adipocyte to adipocyte phase. It is inhibited by the Wnt5a pathway, which encourages osteoblastic differentiation. Takada, Suzawa, Matsumoto et al. Present a basic science paper in which they demonstrate osteoblastic differentiation instead of adipogenic by two different forms of PPAR-gamma repression. The first was through TNF-alpha, and IL-1, with activated NF-kappa-beta blocking PPAR-gamma binding to DNA. The second was WNT5A repression of PPAR-gamma. Both demonstrated a change from the adipogenic induction typical of PPAR-gamma to osteogenic. Moving on to the next question, which of the following growth factors binds and activates the lipoprotein receptor-related protein 5-6 or LRP5-6 during bone development? And the choices are 1, transforming growth factor beta, 2, platelet-derived growth factor, 3, parathyroid hormone, 4, bone morphogenic protein, and 5, WNT protein. So WNT and hedgehog signaling pathways are key regulators of bone formation. Mutations in the WNT and hedgehog pathways result in skeletal malformations as well as osteoarthritis. WNTs are a large family of secreted proteins that is 19 different members in the human genome that transduce their signal through several pathways. The most studied of these pathways is the WNT beta-catenin pathway, in which WNT protein binds to the LRP5-6 receptor at the cell surface and activates an intracellular cascade. This cascade leads to translocation of beta-catenin into the nucleus to activate transcription of genes that control osteoblast differentiation. Agents that stimulate this pathway are under investigation for treatment of osteoporosis. Moving on to the next question. Altered BMP4 signal transduction is known to be associated with which of the following diseases? And the choices are 1, fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva, 2, Mazabrod syndrome, 3, Ollier's syndrome, 4, osteopetrosis, and 5, osteopoikilosis. So altered BMP4 signal transduction is known to be associated with fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva, which is a rare disease also known as Stoneman syndrome. Patients with this disease develop massive spontaneous heterotopic bone, so much so that their bodies literally ossify. There is no known cure for this disease, however, surgical removal of the heterotopic bone can help with patient mobility and seating. Shore and Kaplan review fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva and the genetic defect in the BMP4 signal transduction, which leads to the massive formation of heterotopic bone in these patients. Their review provides an excellent discussion of the normal cell signaling cascade driven by the interactions of various BMP proteins and highlights the consequences when this process doesn't function properly. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 2 is incorrect as Mazabrod syndrome is characterized by polyostatic fibrous dysplasia and multiple intramuscular myxomas known to be associated with mutations in the GNAS1 gene. Answer 3 is incorrect as Ollier syndrome is characterized by multiple enchondromas likely caused by mutations in the parathyroid hormone related protein and the Indian hedgehog protein. Answer 4 is incorrect as osteopetrosis is caused by abnormal number or function of osteoclasts which are associated with mutations in the CLCN7 gene. And answer 5 is incorrect as osteopoikilosis, aka spotted bone disease, is caused by a defect in the LEMD3 gene. Moving on to the next question, all of the following are true of BMP3 except, and the choices are 1, it antagonizes the activity of BMP2, 2, it is the most abundant BMP in demineralized bone matrix, 3, knockout mice have twice as much trabecular bone as controls, 4, it is osteoinductive, and 5, it increases levels of chondrogenic markers like type 2 collagen and aggrecan. So again, bone morphogenic proteins belong to a subgroup of proteins within the TGF-beta superfamily. There are nearly 30 different members of the BMP family. The osteogenic effects of BMP2 and 7 have been well documented, and the cellular effect of many of the remaining BMPs continue to be evaluated. Bahamond and Lyons showed that BMP3 antagonizes the activity of BMP2. They also showed that BMP3 is the most abundant BMP in demineralized bone matrix. Delusky et al. Also showed that BMP3 antagonizes BMP2 and that BMP3 knockout mice have twice as much trabecular bone as controls. Cheng et al. Showed in tissue culture models that BMP2, 4, 6, 7, and 9 were osteogenic. BMP3 was shown to increase levels of chondrogenic markers like type 2 collagen and aggrecan. But with regards to this question, answer 4, BMP3 is osteoinductive is a false statement, making it the correct answer for this except question. And moving on to the final question for this review session, bone morphogenic proteins transduce intracellular signal through what class of cell surface receptor? And the choices are 1, mitogen-activated protein kinase, 2, tyrosine kinase, 3, serine threonine kinase, 4, aurora kinase, and 5, glycogen synthase kinase 3. So bone morphogenic proteins, again, are extracellular proteins belonging to the TGF-beta superfamily of molecules. Members of this family include BMPs, growth and differentiation factors, activin, nodal, and TGF-beta. These proteins exert their action by binding to cell surface receptors of the serine-threonine kinase class to activate intracellular signaling pathways. So the correct answer to this question is 3, serine-threonine kinase. The other kinases participate in various cell signaling functions but are not associated with BMP. That's all for this review session about lumbar spinal stenosis and bone growth factors. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.